If you can keep your name off something, then essentially there's nothing to connect you to the crime you've committed. And that means you can spend as much as you like. So essentially what Moneyland does for you is if you steal money and you want to spend it, before you spend it, you can hide it. And you can hide your involvement in the crime. And that's the power of Moneyland. And that's the new aspect of all this, is that you've always been able to steal and spend, and you've always been able to steal and hide, but you weren't previously able to steal, hide, and spend all together. It's the sort of Moneyland pathway that's beggaring the world.
That is award-winning investigative journalist Oliver Bulla, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back, or welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where we tackle risk and uncertainty in many forms. The aim of what we're doing here is to try and help us all, myself included, embrace uncertainty and understand and tackle the biggest risks of our times. A Merry Christmas and a Happy Holidays to you all, wherever you are and however you celebrate. And before we get into the episode, a little bit of business as usual. We're brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks, and it's December the 24th. If you are stuck for a last-minute Christmas gift, give the gift of Audible, where as a listener to the podcast, you can get a free first month or 30-day trial, which includes a free audiobook, which is yours to keep no matter what. If you are in the USA, simply go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk. Or if you're in the UK, go to the link in the show notes. Okay, today we are going to go on a little trip to a place called Moneyland, which is also the title of the Times of London's Business Book of the Year. It was written by our guest, Oliver Bulla. The full title is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Moneyland is a virtual place, but it is very real. It's where many of the world's mega rich, particularly kleptocrats in a variety of countries, can hide and spend their stolen wealth. And as you'll hear from Oliver, Moneyland is a lawless, stateless country, but it is also the third richest country on earth. And it's one in which the West's own institutions have helped to create it, and in the process, undermine many of the foundations of Western stability. So who is Oliver? Oliver is an award-winning investigative journalist who previously wrote two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, both of which were shortlisted for prizes. Moneyland is an incredibly important and timely book, and one in which Oliver's skills as an investigator and writer come through marvelously. And in this conversation, Oliver shares the origins of Moneyland, how Moneyland works, including how kleptocrats can steal, hide, and spend their wealth and do things like buy passports. We talk about tax havens and how they work. Oliver shares the role of the West in creating Moneyland and how it is now undermining democracy. And even though this is all a bit of a dark story, we end on some positives that Oliver gives us around what we can really do to take back control and to fight Moneyland. And it's somewhat appropriate that this episode goes out the day before Christmas, because 27 years ago, on December the 25th, 1991, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. And that event, as you will hear, was an important prelude to the story of Moneyland. This is a fascinating and important big picture conversation. So let's go and meet Oliver Bulla and take a tour of Moneyland. Enjoy. Welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, and I'm really looking forward to chatting about your latest book, Moneyland. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So for my listeners, Oliver, it'd be great if you could pen or give us an overview of your background and how you got into exploring all things kleptocrats and former Soviet Union and getting into journalism. I think that would be a great place to start.
I'm from Mid Wales, which is a relatively sparsely populated part of the UK. Not the kind of place where high politics tends to happen, you could put it that way. And I grew up slightly obsessed by the comic Tintin comic books. And Tintin comic books, they're not big in the States, but they are basically the adventures of a young journalist who ran around the world a lot of the time in Eastern Europe, having adventures and generally solving crimes and never really filing any articles. I became slightly obsessed by Eastern Europe as a result of Tintin. I thought it just seemed like the most interesting place in the world. And then it became so, you know, in the 1980s and 90s, everything was happening in Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Romania and then Russia, of course, Ukraine and so on. And that was sort of very much seemed like the cockpit of world history at the time. So as soon as I could, which is when I left school, I just sort of headed over there to check it out for myself. And after a while, I began working as a journalist in St. Petersburg in Russia to begin with, and then in Moscow. And that was it. I became a Russianist sort of as a result of that. I learned language and stayed out there just because it was an interesting place to be. And then if you spend any time in Russia, or in fact, almost any of the countries of the former Soviet Union, you start bumping up against kleptocracy. And I suppose it was 2014, the revolution in Ukraine, which really crystallized for me the damage that this kind of egregious transnational corruption was doing to democracy and prosperity, and in fact, just the general prospects of whole generations of people in the former Soviet Union who'd you know, hoped in 1991 when communism collapsed, they hoped that their countries would build sort of prosperous, you know, liberal open societies, and instead they'd built these kind of, you know, semi-dictatorships governed by crooks. And that was, you know, why did that happen? Why was that allowed to happen? That essentially became, you know, the thought process that led to Moneyland, which is the book which has just come out.
Right. Did you have this view? I certainly did when I think we're more or less contemporaries in when we went to university and this sort of thing. I had a view that was very similar to Francis Fukuyama's End of History, that liberal democracy is going to slowly take over, and I think much of the world did at that time. Did you go into your profession thinking that, and was some of your thoughts that crystallized in 2014, did you start to earlier see indications that maybe this part of the world isn't going to follow the path of Western liberal democracy?
Well, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, I didn't really overthink things as a rule. I was I was along for the ride, but you know, I had spent quite a lot of time before I went to Russia in places like Romania and Hungary and the Baltic, the Balkan countries. And I suppose in those places, you know, democracy was catching on, you know, things were becoming more prosperous, change was happening, you know, they were inching towards joining the EU. And, you know, so it did feel like that the world and that part of the world was getting better. So I suppose after I moved to Russia, it took me a while to realize that Russia had a different trajectory. And that in fact, you know, the betrayal of the hopes of a generation of Russians had been not just, you know, sort of as it were, not just a kind of running counter to that, you know, Francis Fukuyama theory that liberal democracy was going to triumph, but had actually, this betrayal had been conducted with the active assistance of many Westerners. You know, it wasn't just Westerners were standing by wringing their hands in dismay. But, you know, Western countries, Western institutions, Western individuals had been helping the crooks and the kleptocrats to steal their money, to launder it and to spend it in our countries. So it isn't just that, you know, that thesis of, you know, is wrong, you know, that liberal democracy isn't the natural endpoint that we all end up at. But actually, liberal democracies and the citizens of liberal democracies have been actively helping it to go wrong. So that's the sort of the core argument I make in Moneyland, really, that these crooks, and I'm thinking about people like, you know, Viktor Yanukovych, the former president of Ukraine, of course, and others like him, that they weren't just stealing money from their own countries, you know, in their own native genius. They were stealing money from their countries and hiding it using the sort of highly skilled intermediaries from London, from New York, from Los Angeles, from San Francisco, from Geneva, from wherever, Zurich. You know, there was a whole sort of body of Westerners who were happy to hold their noses and just take the money, and have been doing so and have got vastly wealthy while doing so. And it's been hugely damaging, you know, to places like Ukraine or Russia. You know, if you just look at sort of health statistics, you know, mortality statistics, you know, just living standards, all of these things have been, you know, stagnating essentially because so much money has been stolen that their governments are, you know, ramshackle, really, you know, not doing the jobs they're supposed to be doing, but instead making people's lives miserable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you describe it so well, and I love the term Moneyland because it encapsulates it perfectly. But it'd be great if you could you just describe what you mean by Moneyland. These people, these kleptocrats, live in Moneyland. What is Moneyland?
Well, Moneyland came to me as an idea in 2014 when I was exploring one of Viktor Yanukovych's residences. This isn't a residence he had as president of Ukraine. This is a residence he'd built for himself with money he'd stolen on land that he'd stolen. And it was kind of a pleasure garden in the middle of a forest, a gorgeous place, you know, with a yacht harbor and a shooting range, a duck lake, a huge sort of hunting lodge, massive outdoor barbecue area. It was really extraordinary. And I'd wandered around this and sort of checked out the heated massage table and the plunge pool and all the kind of amenities. And I said to Anton, who's a friend of mine, who's a revolutionary, I said, how could you have let this happen? How did you let him get away with this? And Anton, he sort of slightly exploded at me, and as far as he ever does, he's a fairly chilled guy. And he just said, listen, we didn't know this was here. We didn't know any of this. You got to understand how well this was hidden. This land, it was in England. You know, it's not in Ukraine at all. And what he meant was that the property that this hunting lodge was built on was owned by an offshore company in the UK. And then that UK company was owned by another UK company, and that was owned by a company in Liechtenstein or a foundation in Liechtenstein. And so essentially, in legal terms, this place wasn't really in Ukraine at all. It was somewhere else. And the whole Ukrainian elite were doing this. It wasn't just the president or the ministers, the lawmen, the oligarchs. They were all keeping all of their property offshore in this way. But the thing about offshore is it's this term that we use a lot, but we don't really understand, because it doesn't. You think of offshore and you think of, I don't know, somewhere in the Caribbean with white beaches and palm trees and so on. You know, that's, or you think maybe Monaco, you know, something like that. You think, well, if it's not offshore, it's not here, then it's there. But it isn't there either. The property isn't anywhere. Offshore just means somewhere else. So I wanted to find a way to understand this. And that's when I came up with the idea of Moneyland, because I said, well, this property, this hunting lodge, it's not in Ukraine and it's not in Britain and it's not in Liechtenstein. It's in Moneyland. And once you start thinking about the world like that, if you look at the amount of property which is held elsewhere, offshore, which is just not where it's supposed to be, you know, it's somewhere between 8% and 10% of all the money in the world, which makes Moneyland the third richest country on earth after the United States and China. And that is a profoundly troubling thought, the idea that there is this sort of, you know, huge store of wealth, which is totally unaccountable, which is totally anonymous, which is out there. And it's like a sort of malevolent poltergeist. You know, we can't see it. We can't touch it. We don't know where it is. But it can see us and it can touch us. So it can interfere in the rest of the world, mm-hmm. as freely as it likes to. But we can't interfere with it. And that makes it a real challenge to the nature of democracy. You know, the core function of a democratic government is to tax the wealth of its citizens for the common good of everyone. If you can't do that because money is anonymously held offshore, then you're not really a democracy anymore. And this is a real challenge to the liberal order, and a challenge that does not get anything like the recognition it needs to have. Mm-hmm.
How many people would you say live in Moneyland?
Well, I mean, it's impossible to put a number on it in terms of individuals, because it isn't just a function of being rich. There are plenty of people who are rich and don't live in Moneyland. I mean, an obvious example here in the UK is someone like J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. who pays all of her taxes, who keeps all her money onshore and so on. It's a function of being both rich and unscrupulous. Mm-hmm. If you're If you're rich and you don't want to either have the origin of your wealth examined because you've stolen it, or you don't want to pay taxes on your wealth because you just don't like paying taxes or whatever, that's what makes you a money lander. It's the combination of being rich and unscrupulous. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing we do know is that the number of people is increasing all the time. The amount of money that is stolen from the world's poorest countries and stashed in money land is estimated by Global Financial Integrity, which is a think tank based in Washington, D.C., is estimated at more than $1 trillion a year. Wow. And a trillion, you know, it's difficult to get your head around some of these numbers, trillion, billion, million, what the difference between them all is. But if you had $1 trillion in dollar bills, if you were to count them, you know, one at a time, one a second till you finished, that would take you more than 30,000 years.
Wow.
If the first humans had arrived in North America, started counting when they crossed the Bering Straits, they'd be about halfway to $1 trillion. It's a massive number, like a really massive number. And that much money is being stolen every year and stashed in Moneyland, which means that Moneyland becomes that much wealthier every year. And that's a very troubling thought.
Mm. It is. And as you say, it's hard to wrap our heads around that amount of wealth. I think there's for most of us, we just assume, okay, really wealthy, but we have no idea, no way of putting that into some sort of context, which creates, I guess, a bit of, I don't know if it's indifference. I don't know if you talk about how we don't hear about this often enough. Is that a function of the media? Is that a function of how divided we are? Is that how does that factor into the equation, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that this isn't a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not describing a sort of James Bond-esque.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this is, you know, there's no villain out there masterminding all this. This is baked into globalization. This is essentially what happens when you allow crooks access to a globalized financial system. I'm not saying globalization is bad necessarily, but it's bad when crooks have unfettered access to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that makes it very hard to do anything about, which is one reason why I think a lot of people have just turned off from this altogether, because, you know, why bother thinking about something if you can't do anything about it? But it's something I try to do with the book, is explain that this isn't just a thing about money. It isn't just money that goes offshore. You can put anything offshore. Mm-hmm. If you're a wealthy oligarch from the former Soviet Union or anywhere, and you decide to become a philanthropist in the UK, that means you can take advantage of British libel law. And essentially, that means you can stop people writing about you because they're going to get sued in the UK and will be shut down. If you do that, then you have your reputation offshore. If you put your children at school in Switzerland or at college in the United States, then your children are offshore. Most extraordinarily, there's a whole new industry in which you can buy a passport. You know, if you are a wealthy Chinese person, for example, or a Malaysian or an Iraqi or a Sudanese person, it's very frustrating to have a passport that doesn't give you visa-free access to most of the world. So you can now put your citizenship offshore. You can buy a citizenship in 5 countries in the Caribbean and now 4 countries in Europe that will sell passports to people who want them. And so you're putting your citizenship offshore. In fact, as I describe in the book, with this rather sort of blackly comic story of a Saudi billionaire called Walid Al Jafali.
You do, yes.
He's a man who bought an ambassadorship in London. Mm. You know, he wanted to avoid having to pay a divorce settlement to his supermodel ex-wife. And so he bought himself an ambassadorship in London and claimed diplomatic immunity. And that, if you do that, you know, you've put everything offshore. It's not just your wealth and your reputation and your children that are offshore. That's your everything. You are now legally immune from any kind of consequences. You know, so Moneyland is about much more than just money. It's about everything, every form of privilege that is essentially, you know, that can be obtained. You can put it offshore. And once you do that, then you're untouchable.
And you can pick and choose which laws and which regulations to obey. You can, you know, not pay taxes, but then have your kids educated in Switzerland or in Britain. It's a menu, right, of the best things across all of the different countries in the world.
Well, that's the joy of it, because it's a function of the fact that laws are national. You know, the British police only can impose its writ within Britain. The same goes for the US police in the US and the Swiss police in Switzerland and so on. But money is international. So for most of us, we only really live in one country. We spend our time in one country. So this isn't really an issue that we think about. But if you're very wealthy, you can live transnationally. Your wealth is transnational. So essentially, if you're very wealthy, then borders cease to have any meaning. So the people who are trying to keep tabs on you, who are trying to possibly prosecute you for wealth, they have to obey national borders. But the people they're pursuing, the very wealthy, the rich and unscrupulous citizens of Moneyland, they get to go wherever they like. They get to do whatever they like. And that is what Moneyland is. It's essentially a pick and mix approach to the legislation of the world or many jurisdiction that suits your interests at any particular period of time.
Actually, perhaps it would be useful to maybe go through the different, you described the different phases of stealing wealth, hiding it, and spending it. And it might be useful to just maybe walk through some of the high-level mechanics of all of this, how wealth is stolen, then hidden, and then spent on things like property and incredible houses in London and New York and things like that.
Yeah, okay. So it's a thing to remember. I mean, there have always been thieves and crooks. This isn't in that regard, there's nothing new here. You know, people have always abused their power, I think, as long as there's been power to abuse. I think that's probably pretty much certain. But what's new is the role of the international financial system and the ability it gives people to hide their wealth. Because once upon a time, if you stole money, the amount of money you could steal was kind of limited by where you could put it. You know, okay, you could build yourself a big house. You could steal a load of money. You could put it in all the rooms in your house. And then what are you going to do with it? You can give it away or you can have it eaten by mice. But that's it, right? I mean, you're up against the sort of the physical limits of storing wealth. The amazing power of the financial system is that it spirits wealth elsewhere, offshore, into a sort of magical transportation box where you don't have to worry about storing it anymore. And you don't have to worry about, you know, having to confront your neighbors with it. You can live somewhere and not have to have your gigantic pile of wealth directly in front of them, because your gigantic pile of wealth is in London or New York or whatever. That's what Moneyland did. And this is actually a relatively recent invention. You can trace it back to the city of London in the 1960s, in fact, 1962-3, when they essentially created this instrument called the Eurobond, which basically allowed people to have anonymous offshore wealth, which paid them an income, which hadn't existed before. It was a very, you know, radical invention. And it was that set money free and that essentially made it very profitable to dodge taxes and very profitable to steal money. And that it's the sort of the successors, the children of the Eurobond, which are these anonymous offshore structures that you can use to hold property in such a way that your name isn't on it. That's what really is the scaffolding of Moneyland. Because mm-hmm. if you can keep your name off something by using a company registered in Nevada or a trust registered in Jersey or a foundation registered in Liechtenstein, if you can keep your name off something, then essentially there's nothing to connect you to the crime you've committed. And that means you can spend as much as you like. So essentially what Moneyland does for you is if you steal money and you want to spend it, before you spend it, you can hide it. And you can hide your involvement in the crime. And that's the power of Moneyland. And that's the new aspect of all this, is that you've always been able to steal and spend, and you've always been able to steal and hide, but you weren't previously able to steal, hide, and spend altogether. It's the sort of Moneyland pathway that's beggaring the world.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how tax havens work? And I found your description of your time in Nevis really interesting, for example, and how frustrating it was to just identify the, you know, simple address for a company, and how that works. I think it'd be interesting for my listeners to hear about that.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, there's a very large demand from people who've got money to hide. And there's a very large demand from people who want to sell things. So, you know, if you can be, you know, the node in between those two, if you can be the place that hides money, that can be a very profitable place to be. And obviously, this is essentially the core business model of tax havens in throughout history. Places like Jersey, in Jersey, in Britain rather than Jersey in the US, places like Switzerland, obviously, places like Monaco, Vanuatu in the Pacific. And then a whole sort of spray of islands in the Caribbean. And one of the reasons the Caribbean is so popular for this is because it has a lot of small jurisdictions, and small jurisdictions, particularly island jurisdictions, are very prone to this industry, because often they were British, so they have British law, so they can function very straightforwardly in communicating with the City of London. And also they speak English, which makes things nice and easy. And islands also just find it difficult to earn a living otherwise, so they like to take advantage of any scams that are going. And there's sort of the most egregious example I found is this island called Nevis, which is it's not a country, it's the junior half of the Federation of St. Kitts and Nevis. St. Kitts and Nevis is mainly famous for selling passports, but Nevis is also has carved out a secondary role as a real bottom feeder of a tax haven. And this was, you know, it's a remarkable example of the extent to which, you know, tax havens enable fraud and theft. You know, the former president of Taiwan's family owned property in the US via, you know, Nevis vehicles. The president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, he had you know, Nevis structures in his property empire. You know, multiple frauds. The flash crash of the Dow in, what was that, 2010? That big fall in the Dow. That was the proceeds went to Nevis. You know, scam after scam across America. Across I mean, I think the biggest ever tax fraud in the UK was again traced back to Nevis. You know, it is a place that sells secrecy as a way of bolstering its national budget, and it does so very successfully. But what's remarkable about it, if you go there, is how you'd never know. It's just, it's a very nice place. It's, you know, it's a little island, you know, kind of beautiful beaches, beautiful palm trees. And it just has these office buildings that just do boring office stuff. It's the sort of the banality of evil encapsulated. You know, you can go into these places and there's just a, you know, a couple of lovely people at desks who are all just doing some kind of work that, like anyone does in any office anywhere. It just so happens that what they're doing is beggaring the world. Right. What's particularly amazing is that the laws of Nevis, which allow them to do this, and they're remarkable laws. I mean, you know, just to bring a court case in Nevis, if you're trying to challenge one of these structures, just to bring a court case, you have to pay a bond of $100,000. Right. And that's before you even begin, you know, cash down. Yeah, you know, that, I mean, that's tough for most people.
Sure.
You know, but those laws were all written by American lawyers. These are American lawyers in you know, all up the West Coast and Florida in particular, who are very keen on securing, you know, essentially an extra layer of protection for their clients. You know, those might be men getting divorced who don't want to pay a divorce settlement, or people who've you know, committed some form of fraud, medical malpractice, who don't want to end up losing their assets. And, you know, these laws were designed for Americans who wanted protection from lawsuits. And then they've just been repurposed by crooks and kleptocrats and thieves from all over the world who want the same protection for themselves, you know, but for even worse reasons. You know, in a way, you might say that these laws were invented to protect naughty people, and now essentially they're being used to protect evil people instead. And this is the story of Moneyland all the way through. These instruments that are used to hide money tended to be invented originally to let Westerners dodge taxes. You know, and yes, you shouldn't dodge taxes, but it's not, you know, as crimes go, it's not murder.
Right.
But then these same structures, these same instruments are then used by, you know, people like Vladimir Putin, people like, you know, the ruling family in China, ruling elite in China, people like that, in order to dodge money that they've stolen in the billions. And that's a real problem because, then it starts undermining the stability of the entire world.
Right. I mean, just to take one country, I think you mentioned that over half of Russian wealth is in this money land.
Yeah, it's that estimate comes from a really interesting piece of research by Gabriel Zucman, who's an academic at the University of California in Berkeley. And he's done research into anomalies in international trade data, because this money, it still exists. The money which is in Moneyland, it's just that we can't see it. So you can see anomalies when money goes out of a country but doesn't come into another country. That's when things go into Moneyland. And he's looked at those anomalies, and he's estimated that the former Soviet Union, Russia, the former Soviet Union, is 52% of all money is offshore, all household wealth. So more than half of all the money in the country, you know, for the countries of the Gulf and the Arab world, it's about 60%. So three-fifths of all the money in the country for in that area. For sub-Saharan Africa, it's more than 40%. So these are serious numbers. You know, if you think about, you know, if, for example, I'm not saying this is likely to happen, but were there to be some form of revolution in Russia and a wonderful public-spirited friendly government were to come into being, who cared more about the well-being of its own citizens and less about getting rich for itself, it would instantly lose access to half of all the money in the country, because half of that money belongs to the current elite. You know, this is a real problem. And it really stymies prospects of democratic transformation. We've seen this in Ukraine. They had the revolution, 4 years ago now, more than 4 years ago, and the government has still not managed to confiscate and to return to state ownership the palace that Yanukovych built for himself on land stole from the government. You know, the signature achievement of the revolution was taking over this palace and keeping it safe for the people, and they've still not managed to return that to state ownership. That's how well protected it is by moneyland. And right. it's an astonishingly difficult system to go up against.
Right, and this is certainly not unique to the Ukraine. I mean, the Marcoses in the Philippines. When was that? 1986, and they still haven't tracked down all the wealth that that the Marcoses allegedly stole from the public coffers.
I think one of the most astonishing examples is Pavlo Lazarenko. So going back to Ukraine, but this is has a U.S. angle. Pavlo Lazarenko was the prime minister of Ukraine. He fled for slightly unexplained reasons, possibly because he hadn't really thought it through. He fled to the US in 1999 and claimed asylum, which was unwise because it meant that he was then held in custody and could be prosecuted. He was prosecuted for corruption, and he had his mansion in California taken away from him. But what was amazing was that was almost exactly two decades ago that he was first arrested. And yet even the US, the most sort of fearsome and diplomatically powerful law enforcement system in the world, still hasn't managed to confiscate the money that he had in other jurisdictions, Antigua and Guernsey and places like that.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, so leaving aside, you know, that case, if you look at somewhere like Nigeria, if it's trying to regain control of assets that have been stolen, Argentina, Malaysia, you know, Afghanistan, you know, any country, you name it, has been suffering this problem, really. It's very, very hard, if not impossible, to regain control of money once it's been stolen and stashed in moneyland. In fact, if you look at the figures, it's certainly less than a cent for every $100 that's stolen, almost certainly less than a cent for every $1,000 that's stolen that's ever recovered and returned to the people it was stolen from.
Right. One of the things that surprised me about the book was the depth through which one can use vehicles in the United States of all places to carry out this type of activity as well.
Yeah, I mean, the US has a sort of bit of a Jekyll and Hyde situation. And the enforcement in the US is very good, far better than it is anywhere else. But regulation is absolutely awful, far worse than it is in any comparable European country. And this is because so many of the states have been making money for decades, if not centuries. Certainly decades, undercutting each other by selling, you know, anonymity. So, I mean, it started off with New York started, you know, having limited liability companies, and then New Jersey undercut New York, and then Delaware undercut New Jersey. And now sort of Nevada is undercutting Delaware, and South Dakota is undercutting Nevada, and Wyoming is undercutting South Dakota. And so you have this endless race to the bottom. And you can, you know, studies of, you know, the worst places, the places that do the least checks when you establish a company and incorporate a company, you know, the US comes bottom on every single scale. It's astonishingly bad. You know, way, way, way worse than the Caribbean tax havens, for example. And this is something which has become increasingly problematic in the post-financial crisis world, because a lot of the stolen offshore money was hidden in Switzerland before, but the United States in the Obama administration was very cross with Switzerland and really put a lot of pressure on it until Switzerland backed down and agreed to stop doing this. And then where did the money go? It didn't go back to the places where it was stolen from. It went to the United States because the United States forces other countries to tell it where, you know, which of its citizens have money in their banks. But it doesn't reciprocate. It doesn't return the favor by telling other countries if their citizens have money in the US. So essentially the best place to put your money now, if you're a foreign kleptocrat, is in a trust in South Dakota or Wyoming or Nevada. You know, and the trust industry in South Dakota since the financial crisis has increased in size from the assets it holds has increased from about $40 billion to $250 billion. And that's just in one state. You know, so it has become the United States, it's no exaggeration to say, is now the new tax haven. Jeez. And previously efforts against tax havens have been largely led by the US and the EU. And obviously the US isn't going to, I mean, it's not able to do anything against Nevada because Nevada has its own competencies to do things in its own way. So who's going to do that? So, you know, we're in a particularly dark place at the moment. But this is a function of Moneyland, because Moneyland has no loyalty to any one jurisdiction. You know, if the money in Moneyland is suddenly starts being treated badly in Jersey or Switzerland or Nevis or wherever, then it'll just go somewhere else. You know, and because it's a sort of endlessly mutating thing. So it's sort of in the cloud. So that's why it's currently, you know, moving to places like Nevada and South Dakota, because that's where it's being treated best.
And we're talking about something that is fundamentally different from, say, the ease of doing business, which, you know, the World Bank talks about, where it sets out this ease of doing business index or governance indicators. And that's one thing in terms of how easy or difficult it is to set up a business. But we're talking about not really setting up businesses. We're talking about things like trusts and shell companies and those types of things. So is there a correlation between, say, ease of doing business and the ability to hide wealth?
I mean, partly. I'm not talking about, in the book, I don't talk at all about, you know, companies like Apple who are abusing, you know, the island tax system in order to not pay taxes in the US, or companies like Vodafone have done the same in the UK. You know, this is a book about crooks and thieves, individuals who've abused the system. But there are aspects of that doing business survey. One aspect of it is that one of the things they take into account when they say how easy it is to do business in your country is how easy it is to create a company. Yeah. Now, creating a shell company is absolutely crucial to kleptocracy, to Moneyland. It is that is the structure around which Moneyland is built, because that's what allows you to hide your money. You've stolen it, you hide it via a shell company, and then you spend it. And it is a problem that the World Bank says that essentially the easier it is to create a company, the better. Now, I mean, in the UK, for example, it's been made astonishingly easy to create companies. It costs just £13, which is about, what, $16. And you can do it in about 15 minutes. You don't have to be in the UK. You don't have to really identify yourself in any particular way. And this means that companies have become, you know, the vehicles of choice for money laundering, particularly out of Eastern Europe. There was a scandal last month related to Danske Bank, a Danish bank, particularly their branch in Estonia, which was, you know, probably the biggest money laundering scandal in history. You know, a volume of money moved sort of 250 times bigger than HSBC moved out of Mexico. You know, and the single biggest group of account holders in Danske Bank's Estonia branch were British shell companies. And yet the government here does absolutely nothing about this because they say it's too expensive. You know, so thousands of millions, you know, billions, that is, of pounds are being stolen from the former Soviet Union. And yet, you know, the UK government isn't prepared to do anything about it because it says it'll cost us hundreds of millions of pounds. So, you know, the benefit would be 1,000 times bigger than the cost, and yet we're still not prepared to do that. And so that is a real problem. And I think actually this idea that the easier you make it to incorporate, the better, that is a profoundly wrong idea. Because, you know, essentially, you know, incorporating yourself and acting via a company when all you want to do is hide your stolen fraud, it's just state-sponsored identity fraud. That's all it is. And yet we're pretending it's something else. And this isn't what companies are created for. Companies are created to encourage entrepreneurship. They're not supposed to encourage fraud. And, you know, and that's something that we really should be doing something about. And to be honest, it's encouraging that certainly in the UK, there's a big push towards making this harder to do. And in the US now, there is as well. There's a group called the FACT Coalition in the US who have been doing some really good work, bringing together all different stakeholders from NGOs, from the banking sector, from big business. Even the Secretary of State of Delaware has now signed up saying that he wants companies to record their true owners. You know, so that's good. And, you know, so we're moving in the right direction, but we've got a really long way to go.
Right. Could we talk a little bit about the role of the so-called enablers of all of this, the bankers, the accountants, the consultants, et cetera, in the lawyers in Western countries where their role is to, or there is an industry of helping the kleptocrats hide their wealth. What are your thoughts on that? So say, for example, the big four accounting firms or big law firms that work with some of these individuals as clients?
Well, the thing is that it's very hard to persuade someone of the course of action if it's going to cost them. I think that's just a sort of a broad principle across all of human history. And a whole industry has grown up, particularly in London and New York, but in other cities too, that has essentially servicing the interests of the rich and unscrupulous. I mean, you know, obviously these are people who, real estate agents who sell, you know, high-end condos in New York or you know, mansions in London to crooks from wherever, from the former Soviet Union, from wherever. You know, obviously, you know, they're the sort of the kind of most unacceptable face of it. But it's not just them. It's the PR agents who launder their reputations. It's the accountants who structure their businesses. It's the lawyers who sue journalists on their behalf. You know, all of these professionals are enabling the fraud and the theft that is beggaring the world. You know, there was an astonishing piece of research by a Global Witness, I think 3 or 2 years ago, in which they went to a number of lawyers in New York and essentially presented themselves as acting on behalf of an African kleptocrat and said, would you help us hide our money so we can spend it in the US? And only one of the lawyers told them no. The others all started suggesting ways that this could be done. And they, and, you know, and the Global Witness had got this all on camera, so we know what happened. You know, and that was a really telling example of how the sort of morals of our professions have really failed to keep up with the economy, as we, you know, that they you know, a lot of what they're doing is legal because these are the people who write the laws, but it's very definitely immoral.
How do we stop this? What are some of the things that we should think about doing in order to cut perhaps we can never stop it, but at least to cut down on this type of activity?
I mean, the key thing, and I see this again and again and again when I talk to law enforcement professionals who are in this world trying to do something about this. The key thing is to introduce transparency of ownership. You know, again, I go back to saying, what is a company supposed to be for? You know, essentially, if you have a limited liability company, you are basically the whole of society the risk of your business venture, because your business venture is deemed to be good for society. This is a way of encouraging entrepreneurs. So it's a form of insurance. But no one gets to have insurance anonymously. That's crazy. You don't get to insure a house and not tell an insurance company who you are. But that's basically what's happening. You know, anonymous shell companies are essentially a form of socialized risk for the entirety of society. The benefit is entirely for the owner of the company. And they don't even have to say who they are. I mean, this is, you know, way, way, way beyond what the creators of companies originally intended them to be for. So we need to go back to a time when if you create a company, you have to say who you are. And if, and there are people out there in the world, you know, Hollywood film stars or, you know, victims of domestic violence or whoever, these are people who deserve to have anonymity and need to have anonymity. But that anonymity should be provided to everyone who needs it, not to people who could afford it. You know, and it's that those two things should be broken out apart. Companies and anonymity should have nothing to do with each other. And that's an absolutely crucial step. I mean, there's one federal law enforcement agent I spoke to in Miami who told me that half of his time is spent trying to work out who owns what, you know, which means that if there was transparency of ownership, he could do twice as many investigations. It's an astonishing figure. And I heard that repeated all across, you know, across different countries, across different agencies. That's just a normal thing for them to say. Absolutely, the transparency of ownership is crucial. And you will meet a lot of opposition from very wealthy Westerners who don't like paying taxes. But it's really important that that's overcome because it's never going to be easier to secure this than it is right now.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? You mentioned Global Witness, but what about other people, what other members of civil society? I mean, how strong is civil society around this area? Because that's perhaps another thing that needs to happen so that we get more awareness.
It's quite strong here in the UK.
Sure. Okay.
I think there's a growing, I think because of London's possibly unique role, or not quite unique, but certainly world leading role in enabling the theft of the world, we're also quite good at being aware of this. So, you know, obviously Global Witness, Transparency International, Corruption Watch, a number of other groups have been very good at this. There isn't quite, I don't think, the prominence in the United States as there is here. But I mentioned the FACT Coalition earlier. There are also other, you know, groups in Washington, the Kleptocracy Initiative at Hudson Institute, and various others who are doing some really valuable work in this area as well. So it's taking off there. In Paris, there is some very imaginative work being done by a group called Sherpa, doing sort of legal work against kleptocrats. So, civil society is doing quite well. But I think really the place that I've been, which has had the most extraordinary civil society, have achieved the most remarkable results, has been Ukraine, where amazingly brave activists stood up to a really grotesque government and faced it down and have achieved some, not everything they wanted, but have achieved some really impressive wins ever since, particularly in the sphere of reducing corruption in the purchase of medicine. It made it much easier to buy medicine, at a reasonable price now, when it was really tough before. So, to be honest, we could all learn a few lessons from Kiev right now.
Right, right. That is interesting. And you also, I think, talk about the relationship between all of this and the populism that we're experiencing right now in and across the globe. Brazil, I suppose, being the latest example, and the threats to democracy. You talk about the Ukraine, obviously the Crimea annexation that occurred. One could attribute directly to kleptocracy. Where do you see some of the biggest risks to the world in which we live and to democracy? What are you, optimistic, pessimistic, indifferent? What is your sense of things right now?
I think the problem we're facing, the Moneyland problem, is an inherently transnational one. The problem is created by the fact that the rich and unscrupulous are able to hide their money anywhere they like, any country in the world. And that is the core problem, that their wealth is treated better than the rest of us are. And any movement that seeks to put up barriers and prevent international cooperation in the campaign against this wealth is therefore a problem. What we need is more international cooperation between, the countries of the EU or the countries of the OECD or the G7 or whatever, not less. So any political movement, and I'm thinking here obviously of President Trump and of Brexit, but not just them, also we see Viktor Orban in Hungary, the Polish government, the Turkish government, any movement that seeks to essentially erect walls against people but not against money is a movement that is inherently harmful, because the problem is not immigrants without money. The problem is immigrants with money. They're the ones who are undermining our systems. And these sort of fear-mongering about, refugees, the refugees are essentially being driven out of their countries like Syria or Ukraine or the countries of Central America, because those countries have been so badly looted that they're falling apart, and yet then we're welcoming their money here, but we're not welcoming the people here, so that if we really want these immigrants not to turn up in countries, then we need to help them solve their countries at home. These people don't want to leave home. They want to stay at home. Everyone wants to stay at home. But if we're going to help them improve their countries, we need to stop it helping their government steal money and stop accepting that stolen cash. So to my mind, we need more transnational cooperation and not less, which means that, sadly for me, that the phenomenon of President Trump and the phenomenon of Brexit are inherently harmful, which is very ironic, because I think a lot of the people, not all of by a long shot, but a lot of the people who voted for President Trump and voted for Brexit did so because they were essentially complaining about Moneyland. They were complaining about the international elite, complaining about a sort of, feeling that they would be able to take back control from these kind of unaccountable, rulers that they had. And actually, they've ended up doing something which will just perpetuate the problem, which is a shame.
Sure. It's such a structurally, it's so difficult, because all it takes is a few jurisdictions through which one can do this.
That's absolutely right. But again, that's not that's something we could change. It would be quite easy to say you can't own property in the UK or in the US or Switzerland or wherever. You can't own property anonymously. You have to declare who owns it. In fact, Britain is doing that, though. It's not for a little while. It's not for another 2 years. And if you do that, it doesn't really matter if you own your property through Nevis anymore, because you won't have obtained the anonymity that you're relying on. So it is in our power in the sort of the wealthy countries of the West to do something about this. It's somewhere like Nigeria or Afghanistan. You know, they're already doomed. You know, they need our help to solve this problem. But fortunately, we're in the fortunate position of being able to solve it on our own. I'm hoping that if Moneyland achieves anything, it will be to show people that the problem is in the West. And that corruption is not just about where the victim is, but also where the culprit is. And if the culprit is here, then we need to solve that problem here. And if we do that, then maybe corruption, you know, won't exist to nearly the same scale as it does at the moment.
Well, that's quite a positive note, because as individual citizens, it means that, you know, through our democracy, we can do something about that. I mean, we can lobby our representatives. We can we can raise awareness of the issue and so forth. So in some respects, what you're writing about is it's very important to identify the problem as you do. So
a brief anecdote. I mentioned earlier that Ukrainians got good at campaigning on medical corruption. After the revolution in Ukraine, it took a real arm wrestle, but they got there in the end. They took medicine procurement away from the corrupt officials who had been running it and the corrupt Ukrainian companies, and they gave it to two UN agencies and one British not-for-profit company. Those three international bodies ran procurement on their behalf and instantly cut prices for medicines being paid by the Ukrainian government by 40%, 40. That most exactly the same medicines. There's no difference in the quality, no difference in any form. They were the same medicines being bought from the same factories, but they got them for 40% cheaper just because they weren't corrupt. You know, and that is a win. You know, and you can these small sort of seeming technical improvements can achieve absolutely massive, massive results. You know, again, we saw this with when FinCEN states started insisting that companies that were buying cash purchases of property in nowhere in the US, but in the major markets in Miami-Dade in LA and New York and other places, that cash purchases of property via shell companies had to declare their true owner. And we saw that these purchases just drop off a cliff. Right. You know, so these small changes can have a massive result. It's not a question of making the world perfect immediately, but even a small change can shift the dial in the direction of, you know, the good guys. And that's a positive thought.
Right. No, absolutely. Was there anything that surprised you in the course of researching this book?
I was very surprised to discover the US role in perpetuating Moneyland, particularly in its latest iteration. You know, I suppose I'd been very aware of the sort of villainous nature of the UK and particularly its network of tax havens for a long time. But I was surprised to discover that the US was at this. And I suppose the lesson is that everyone is, really. There are very few countries in the world, possibly, I don't know, Bhutan possibly, and that's it, that aren't involved in this one way or another. It's a true global network in which money is being sucked out of, you know, the likes of China and ending up in the likes of the US, with the active connivance of the political class in both countries. And that means it's a very hard thing to do something about. You know, I suppose I hoped that in writing the book, this is a silly way of putting it, but a little bit of me hoped that someone would stand up at one of the events I do or would write me an email and say, you know what, I understand why you think that way, but you're wrong. Actually, it's fine. We're really getting on top of this. Because it's such a depressing thought, the idea that essentially there's this sort of unaccountable wealth running around the world and that we're really unable to do anything about it. But in fact, the opposite has happened. I've had emails from law enforcement professionals from all sorts of places, just saying, well, I'm really glad someone's finally written about this, because no one's noticed this for so long. So, you know, it is bad, but being aware of it is the first step towards recovery. So, you know, we're kind of on our way now.
You've done a fine job. I mean, an excellent job in laying it out in this book. And it's also a colorful read because, you know, you love to, I, it's always fascinating to me to read about, just the extraordinary, whether it's homes or lifestyles of some of these individuals. And it really brings it all home, because without that, it's all sort of nebulous. You know, yeah, there's a whole bunch of rich people, and there always will be, and there's nothing I can do about it. That's kind of, I think, the default position that most of us walk around with. So it's
I mean, it's essentially a depressing story. I'm not gonna hide that, but I had a lot of fun coming up with fun ways of telling it. I think that the most fun I had was structuring the entire chapter around an episode of Say Yes to the Dress, the reality television show, just because, you know, it's an utterly daft program about women buying wedding dresses and generally having, you know, family dramas and then ending up happy. And the fact that essentially you could use an episode of this to demonstrate the fact that you know an entire segment of our economy is open to anyone with money, no matter where that money comes from. Because in one of the episodes, you know, the daughter of an Angolan politician, a high-ranking Angolan politician, had spent $250,000 on wedding dresses for herself and her bridesmaids and her mother. You know, that was a pretty fun way of telling that story. And I hope that if you read that chapter, you have a laugh while reading it. You know, it's inherently depressing, but also it's kind of funny. And that's the thing, because a lot of this is black humor, right? You have to laugh with it a bit, otherwise you sort of more or less give up. I think the book is, yeah, it's depressing and it's worrying, and if it doesn't make you angry, you're probably not paying attention. But it also, you know, hopefully it'll make you laugh as well.
Yeah, and I suppose people who don't spend any time in London, don't live in London, it's important for all of us, but you know, you walk around London and you see these places like One Hyde Park and these mansions and so forth, and it's just it's extraordinary. It's just not, it's unbelievable the amount of wealth that's just right under our noses.
My personal favorite is Dmitry Firtash, the Ukrainian oligarch who bought himself a mansion in West London, just down the road from Harrods, for £60 million.
Yeah.
And then that wasn't really enough, so he bought the neighbouring tube station for another £53 million.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, yeah, for a man who has everything, a tube station. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty extraordinary.
It is, yeah. And it's a little bit more, you know, it's still not quite in your face in London, but it's, you know, if you anywhere in that sort of in the West End or around Kensington or near Harrods, or you know, just seeing Lamborghinis on the street, and you know, just the shops, and whether it's the McLaren, was it the McLaren shop on the ground floor of One Hyde Park, it's clear there's a different universe here.
I mean, there's two Rolex shops on opposite sides of the street. You know,
yeah.
People can't be bothered to cross the road to buy a Rolex.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah,
it is. We covered quite a lot of, ground. Were there any other aspects of Moneyland that, that we didn't get a chance to explore that you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's pretty much all of it. I mean, it's in our hands to do something about it. I think that's the main message that I'd hope that people would take away from the book. You know, it's bad and it's worrying, but it, you know, we can help, and it's something we can solve.
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to, you know, to sort of wrap it up, because as you say, we can get very despairing about the state of the world, but and if you link all of this stuff back to where things are on Brexit, and you know, if one thinks that populism isn't a good thing, then well, this is, you know, there are some levers for us to perhaps get our you know, to truly get our countries back, or make our countries great again, perhaps.
Absolutely, I quite agree,
Oliver. I really appreciate you're taking the time to speak to me. Before we go, where can my listeners follow you and find you and get a copy of the book?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Oliver Bullo. I spend probably too much time there. The book has been released in the UK. It came out in September, published by Profile, available in all good bookshops, obviously, and on Amazon.co.uk. It will be released in the US in May, published by St. Martin's Press. I'm just finishing up some little extra bits for the US edition now. Any Dutch, Polish, or Turkish speaking? We're currently doing Dutch, Polish, and Turkish translations, and we're in negotiations to do some other countries' issues, but we haven't signed those contracts yet. And I am going to record an audio version in January.
Okay.
So that'll be out at some point in the new year. But at the moment, that's all there is.
That's fabulous. That's great. Oliver, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Wish you all the best.
Okay. Cheers.
Bye for now. I found that incredibly fascinating, and I hope that you did too. And by the way, Oliver used to run these kleptocracy tours of London, where you could go and visit the outside of the homes purchased by these kleptocrats. And while he's not running these tours any longer, you can visit all the places. Oliver has some YouTube videos on the topic. And if you find yourself in London, or if you live here, you can do a little mini kleptocracy tour. Links to this and everything else that we covered are in the show notes. And we've got one more episode to go in 2018. It'll be out in 7 days on the 31st. That will be a look back at 2018 and some of the biggest risks of 2019. So don't miss it. And make sure you subscribe to All Things Risk. Simply go to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk, and you can find every way in which you can do that. That's all. Happy holidays, and speak to you next week. And in the interim, don't forget, risk is life.